Now tonight, I've really been torn because I have a favorite message in my life. And it's from 1 Thessalonians 1. But some of you have already heard that. Probably hadn't done much for you, but you've heard it anyway. So we're going to go to chapter 2 tonight. I don't like to get very far from chapter 1. And let me tell you a little bit why. You know, the very first letter that Paul wrote was 1 Thessalonians. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's the very first letter. People that have studied carefully the life of Paul, that's not even debatable. Occasionally you'll find someone at some book, it may say Galatians, but people that have studied carefully know that that doesn't hold much water. He wrote that probably very close to when he wrote Romans, and you can study the two and see a great deal of comparison. The 1 Thessalonians was the very first letter that Paul ever wrote. And if you want to know why he had the phenomenal ministry that he had, you study 1 Thessalonians, especially the first three chapters. Now, Paul had been in Thessalonica, we know from Acts chapter 17, verses 1 through 9. He had been there for some time. We do not know how long. We know for sure he'd been there for 3 weeks because it said he reasoned for three Sabbath days out of the Scriptures. Then they ran him out of the synagogue, and he probably stayed there a while longer, maybe 6 months, maybe a year and a half. He could not possibly, from what we know of his life, been there over about 2 years, two and a half at the very longest. And it's good to keep that in mind as we see what happened, because Paul was there a very short period of time. And sometimes I've heard that used as an excuse. You hear it sometime with students or sometime lay people. Well, I'm only going to be here a couple of years. Well, that is just long enough to totally revolutionize somebody's life. Fact is, I remember one time one of our students who served with Jim Peterson down in Brazil, and he was in Norman working on his support. And one day he visited with John Crawford. He was later sharing it with me, and he said, John had asked him, said, "Who are you helping?" He said, "Well, I'm home raising support." And he said, I understand that. And John, this may not be a direct quote, but it's somewhere in the ballpark, I think. He said, "I understand that, but who are you helping?" "Well, you mean in Brazil?" "No, I mean here." "Well, I'm home raising support, and I'm only going to be here 3 weeks or whatever." "Yeah, but who are you helping?" And you know, John tried to get over the idea to him, there ought never be a time in your life that you're not helping somebody. I mean, if you go on a week vacation, I mean, talk to the little maid that comes in to make up the bed or something, but don't ever take a vacation from helping somebody. And it could be that though it's for a very short period of time, it would totally revolutionize that person's life, or as is true, we see from 1 Thessalonians that a number of people in a city, because Paul was there, and he was probably there about 6 months or perhaps a little longer. And so he had a phenomenal ministry in a very short period of time. Now, I want us to go to chapter 2, and I want to begin to read for you in verse 7. This is 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning with verse 7. "But we prove to be gentle among you, like a nursing mother, as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. Having thus a fond affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not the gospel of God only, but also our own lives, because you had become very dear to us. For you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devotedly and unrightly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you that believe. Just as you know how we exhorted and encouraged and implored each one of you as a father would his own children, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you unto his own kingdom and glory." Now, there are three things I want to point out to you from this chapter on how to have a multiplying ministry. And I want us to look at verse 12. We're going to go backwards in this passage, and that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, because sometimes Paul would do something, and he'd do this and this and this, and then he says in verse 12, "so that." I did these things so that. And so we want to see where he's going, and we'll back up and see how he got there. In verse 12, he says, so that you may walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. And the first thing I want to say to you, if you want to have a multiplying ministry, if you want to have a ministry with men, the first thing you've got to do is set a goal. You've got to know where you're going with a man. And Paul knew that. He said, I'm doing this so that you may walk worthy of God. And I want you to see again and again through the Scriptures, you see this idea. Paul knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to raise up a quality of man that would walk worthy of God for the rest of his life. And he says in the next chapter, chapter 3, verse 13, he mentions all these things and he comes to that so that again. So that he may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ with all his saints. So that he may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness. And again through the Scriptures, you see the idea that Paul knew where he was going. He was trying to raise up men who'd be worthy of God, who would stand before him in holiness and be blameless. Many of you would know Ephesians 4, 11 through 13. He gave some apostles and some prophets, some evangelists and pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints for the work of the ministry, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, unto a mature man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And so, the thing Paul was always pushing for, he knew where he was going. He was trying to bring people up to full maturity in Christ. Some of you know Colossians 1, 28 and 29. He says, so naturally we proclaim Christ. We warn everyone we meet. We teach everyone we can all that we know about Jesus, so that if it is possible, we can bring every man up to his full maturity in Christ. He said, that's what I'm working at all the time with all the strength God gives me. Now, our job is to try to be used of God to raise up men who would grow to maturity and be the kind of men God wants them to be. And you need to always have that in mind. You know, as I work with students, I can honestly say, when I look at a student, many times the thing that's in my mind is I think, oh God, how can we help that student to grow to maturity and become the man or woman that you had in mind when you created him for your glory? Now, we need to have that in mind. Here's where we're going with someone. I'm not basically just trying to get them to attend a Bible study. I want them to attend a Bible study, but a Bible study is a method. That's a means to the end. I may take them to a conference, and we'll be going to Glen Eyrie in a couple of weeks. We usually take almost a couple of hundred students during spring break. We had 153 signed up, I think, when I left yesterday. And I want them to go to that conference, and the reason for it is not just to attend a conference. I want them to be exposed, and the desire of my heart is to see that they have an opportunity. Now, I know some of those students will not respond. There'll be some of them that probably will not respond to the Lord, but I don't know which ones will. And so I want to do all I can. Paul said, so that if it's possible, I can bring every man up to his full maturity in Christ. Now, I can't personally train every man, but when you have big meetings, another 50, if there were 50 more men here tonight, it wouldn't take away necessarily from what we're doing. Because in the large groups, and incidentally, men, we need to keep a balance in our ministries from what we see in the New Testament. In the New Testament, you see large group meetings. And the large group meetings are very good for worship. They're very good for preaching. You can do some instruction. Large meetings are very good for motivation. And Jesus used those, and you see them in the New Testament. But then you also see the small group. The small groups are much better for sharing. It's much better for accountability. The small groups are much better for instruction. And Jesus had the small groups. And then you see a third thing in the New Testament, and that's man-to-man. Man-to-man is much better for building. And you may have the person in the large group, the small group, but then when you get him in a man-to-man situation, you can meet the specific needs he has. You can instruct him. You can encourage him. Sometimes in a large group or small group, you may talk and totally miss him. So there's a balance of all those, the large groups, the small groups, and the man-to-man. And all three of them are valid methods. We don't want to get hung up and just use one. You know, that's one of the things I, I appreciate so much about John is because John, he's for reaching people of all ages. He's for encouraging any and everybody he can. I know years ago when I first met him, and I was with the Baptist Student Union, and I wasn't real sure that as a result of that, not leaving and joining that group, that I could ever get all that much help. And I met John Crawford and Jim White and some men like that who were very, very encouraging to me and wanted to help me any way they could and wanted to help me in my ministry. And men, we do all of these things try to bring men to full maturity in Jesus Christ. It does not bring honor and glory to Jesus Christ to see a man reached and see him living like he's always lived. We want all of our lives, as much as is possible, to see people grow to full maturity so that they are looking like Jesus Christ, so that they're like him. That's the goal. That's what we're working at all the time with all the strength God gives us. Now, men, in order for that to happen, the place we have to start is with evangelism. And you always have to work on that. That's sometimes hard to keep in balance. But I want you to notice what Paul says in verse 7. Or verse 8. He says, "Therefore, having a fond affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you." Now notice, not the gospel of God only. That wasn't all he imparted, but the point I'm... And we'll come back and deal with that later. But the point I want you to see is one thing he did impart was the gospel. Not just the gospel, but he very clearly imparted the gospel. In fact, he imparted the gospel at tremendous price to him. Look at verse 9. He says, "You recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day, so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God." He says in another place in chapter 3, verse 10, "Night and day we kept praying earnestly that we might see your face and perfect that which is lacking in your faith." Now, Paul says here earlier that he worked. He worked in verse 9. He said, "I worked night and day." He worked with his hands to make his own living so he wouldn't be a burden, so he could impart the gospel to these people. Now, Paul lived to get the gospel out. And men, whatever you do in life, preach the gospel. I shared with you last night out of Acts 17:17. There are two places you ought to have your ministry. You have it in the context of the church or someplace where believers are gathered, but then in the marketplace every day with those that happen to be present. Now, many of you, as you go out from here next week, you don't know who you're going to meet on your job. You don't know what salesman is going to come in. And the Bible says every day with those that happen to be present. We are to be a witness every day, everywhere, every opportunity that we have. Now, I want to share an experience or two with you. Some things that God taught me back earlier in life, and I hope I never forget these lessons. As I said, it's hard to keep a proper balance. And you'll find, even in a discipling ministry, that there are going to be times that you will do one aspect of it more than another. I mean, it's just a fact. There's times, I know when I came to the University of Oklahoma, we had to do evangelism and a great deal of it to try to get the ship turned around and get it headed in the right direction. Now, we always are to do evangelism. We're always to do follow-up. We're always to do training. But there will be, in just the ebb and flow of life, you will not have the same strengths every day in every one of those areas. They will not always be the same. But men, one of the things you need to learn, and if you're going to have a multiplying ministry, is you've got to share the message. Paul said back in chapter 1, he said, "Our gospel," in verse 5, "it didn't come to you just in word only, but it came also in power and the Holy Spirit and with full conviction." He said, that's the way the gospel came. Now, the power is in the gospel and not you. Now, see, sometimes we have a fear of witnessing because somewhere we got the idea that it depended on how powerful our life is. Men, that is not true. Now, I want you to listen to something because this may be a shock to some of you. Most of you have thought the great Apostle Paul just roared around the earth preaching to anything that moved. He was the tiger type. He wasn't afraid of anything. He just loved preaching. He preached all the time. He never had a problem with fear. He didn't know what that was like. Now, I want you to listen to what the Bible says. 1 Corinthians 2, 1 through 5. Paul said, "And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech." Now, I don't know everything it takes to be a great witness, but one, it doesn't take excellency of speech, or of wisdom. And he said, "Declaring unto you the testimony of God, for I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified." Now listen to the next verse. "I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling." Did you get that? That's the great Apostle Paul writing. "I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling." And he said, "In my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom," but listen to this, "it was in demonstration of the Spirit and of power." And if you were like I was, I didn't think those two things could go together in the same life. The fear and the much trembling, and yet speaking in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. You know, I just thought, you needed to have your act together. In some way, if you had hesitations and you had some problems with boldness at times, that's not the time to speak. Like the power was in you. You know, 1 Peter 1:21 says, "Being born again, not of corruptible seed, but of incorruptible, by the Word of God, which lives and abides forever." That's the way we're born again. And the power's in the Word. I remember one night in college, going into a boy's room to witness to him. And when I walked in and tried to witness to him, he was less than receptive, and that's putting it lightly. In fact, as I started to pull out a New Testament I had in my pocket, and he said, "Don't you pull that out in here." And that shocked me. And I was just trying to learn how to witness. And I ran into that, so I kind of stood there, and I felt kind of stupid. And I didn't know exactly what to do, but I hope I've learned one thing in life: when you don't know what to do, pray. And I didn't close my eyes or anything, but I just prayed and said, "God, what do you do?" And then I said to the fellow, I said, "Well, you know, the reason I came tonight is because Jesus Christ has changed my life, and I just wanted to share it with you." He said, "I am not interested." And so I tried to talk with him, and every time I'd say something, he'd say, "I am not interested." And so I finally just kind of said, "Well, I hope the day will come that you'll give some thought to your relationship to God." He said, "I am not interested." And so I thanked him and walked out. As far as I could tell, I had been an absolute failure. The next fall, I was in Houston, Texas for a BSU convention. We came out of the noon meeting one day, and I was walking down the street, and a fellow came up behind me and slapped me on the back, and he walked around and stood right in front of me. He said, "You go to Texas A&M, don't you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Do you remember me?" And I knew I'd seen him, but I honestly didn't remember where. And he said, "You came to my room one night and tried to talk to me about Jesus, and I told you I was not interested." He said, "You know, I went home that summer. It was just a while before school was out." And he said, "I don't know why, but," he said, "you know, a guy invited me to go to a revival meeting." And he said, "I told him I'd go." And he said, "I would never have told a guy I'd go to a revival meeting. But," he said, "I did." And he said, "I went." And he said, "The second night I was saved." He said, "Two nights later, God called me to preach." And he said, I've transferred to Baylor." Said, "I never dreamed I'd ever see you again." And you know, I thought about that. Another time I was on a way to Glorieta, and I took a young fellow with me I wanted to teach to witness. So we decided we'd go into Santa Fe a day early and witness. And we'd go out to the parks and witness around. And so one day we started back down to our car, and I glanced through the window of a hotel, and I saw a man there that I knew. He's from Littlefield, Texas, and it's not all that hard to remember the people from Littlefield. And so I walked in and I said, "Sir, aren't you from Littlefield, Texas?" And he said, "I sure am." I said, "Are you over here on vacation?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, sir, the reason I'm here today is that we're out telling people about Jesus. And He's changed their life and my friend's life. And I said, now we're going to a camp out here. The conference starts tomorrow, but the reason we're here today is because we're talking to people about the Lord. And I said, sir, have you ever come to know the Lord in a personal way? And he kind of laughed and looked to be about a 16-year-old boy behind the desk, and he laughed, and this guy laughed. And so I started trying to talk to him, and he just stood there and laughed. And I asked him, I said, well, he said, well, son, my wife's a good church member. And I said, great, but have you ever come to know the Lord? And he said, you'd be surprised at the money I give to the church. And I didn't know if he was just playing with me and an old deacon or if he was just as lost as he could be. And finally came to the conclusion the latter was true. And finally, I couldn't make any headway with him. And he said, why don't you tell it this boy over here? He needs it a whole lot worse than I do. And they were both standing there laughing. And I prayed again. And the Lord gave me an idea. And so I just looked at him. And I said, sir, you may think this is kind of funny, but someday you'd give anything in the world if you'd have listened. And I handed him a track, Billy Graham track, and walked out. And I glanced back through the window and I saw him standing there tearing that track up. He and that boy just laughing. Well, that was August. I went home Christmas to see my parents. I went up one day to see the pastor. And he said, Max, I'm so delighted you're in town. I'd just gotten in that afternoon, Sunday afternoon. He said, you know what's happening in our church tonight? I said, no. And he said, you remember the man you talked to in Santa Fe, New Mexico? He said, I'm baptizing he and his wife tonight, so they've both become Christians. And he said, let me tell you how it happened. He said, I've gone to that man's house many times, and I can never get in the door. Another day, he said, I thought I ought to try one more time. So he said, I went to the man's house. He said, I'd gone before, knock on the door. When he saw who it was and he saw it was a preacher, he had just motioned me off and said, I don't want to talk to any preacher. And he said, when I knocked on the door that day, he came to the door and saw who it was. He said, old preacher, come in here. I need to talk to you. He said, preacher, you know that old tall, skinny kid? He said, he walked into motel in Santa Fe and witnessed me, and he said, I didn't appreciate it. But he said, you know, ever since last August, you better listen. Someday you'd give anything in the world for you to listen. And that had been eating on him, and he accepted the Lord. Let me tell you one other story. This friend of mine and I had been asked, and we were juniors in college, and all this time I'm going back to share some stories. There have been some others since, but way back there, God began to show me the power of the gospel. And we'd been asked, we were in Houston, and we'd been asked to go see a Jewish boy. A girl had asked us if we'd go see this boy she'd met in a class. Said he's Jewish and he's not a Christian. Said, would you go talk to him? And so we went over to his room one day, and we knocked on the door, and as we were knocking, a boy entered the hall down a ways, and he said, just a minute. We were knocking on his door, and he came up, and he's coming in off the athletic field. We told him who we were and why we were there. We were Christians, and we'd come to tell him because of a friend that knew him in one of the classes and told him the girl's name. We wanted to come tell him what Jesus had done for us. And he said, well, fellas, I'm in a hurry. I need to get dressed, but you can come on in just a moment. So we just stood in his room, and he started getting ready. And for just a few brief moments, we told him what Jesus Christ had done for us. We walked out and started down the hall, and I never will forget. I said to my roommate, you know, as far as I can tell, we were an absolute failure. We made no impact at all on his life. About all I can tell, the good we did what the girl asked us to do, and we tried. And I believe it's right to try. A few years later, I was in seminary, and one night I got a call from a girl that was in one of my classes, and she said, Max, were you in First Baptist Church in Dallas tonight? And I said, no, that's where I was a member, but I happened to be speaking in the church. She said, let me tell you what happened. Said there was a Jewish evangelist here that Dr. Criswell had asked to come speak. And said he started sharing his testimony. And he said, a number of years ago, I was a student at the University of Houston. And one day I came in off the athletic field and two Aggies were knocking on my door. And he said, they came and told me what Jesus Christ had done for them. He said, I didn't think a whole lot about it, but he said, I couldn't forget it. And he said, after a period of time, he said, I went to a friend who I knew is a Christian and told him about these fellows coming to visit and said, can you tell me more about that? And he became a Christian and he goes all over this country preaching today. Well, God began to show me at times, and I list those incidents because times in all three of those situations, as far as I knew, It had been a complete failure. And yet, the Spirit of God had worked. Now, men, it's right to witness. And the power is not in you. The power is in the gospel. And if we're going to bring men to full maturity, they must be born again. Leighton Ford says a new birth is not just a nice idea, it's an absolute necessity. And nobody will come to full maturity in Christ unless they are born again. And that's where we must start in trying to bring men to walk with God. Now, we've said we've got to set the goal. We've got to share the gospel. Now, number two, I want you to notice what Paul says in verse 10. He says, "You're witnesses, and so is God, how devotedly, uprightly, and blamelessly we behave towards you believers." Now, here the point Paul's making is you must set the pace. We've said you must set the goal, you must also set the pace. And in verse 10, he talks about this. "You are witnesses, and so is God. You saw my life, and so did God, and you know how devotedly, uprightly, blamelessly we behaved ourselves towards you believers." And here again, as Paul did in the first chapter, he calls attention to the quality of life that he lived. Men, if we're going to have a multiplying ministry, we have got to set the pace. We have got to be the example for others to follow. And again in the New Testament, you see this. As Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:12, and he said, "Let no one despise your youth. Don't let anyone look down on you because you're young, but be an example of the believers." And the first thing he mentioned to Timothy is be an example in word. And men, I hope you'll guard the words that come from your mouth, and that you'll make a decision right here at this conference once and for all that as long as you live, there'll never be anything come out of your mouth that's the least bit off color. That you'll decide once and for all that you'll never tell a dirty joke. See, Paul said in Ephesians 4:29, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth," and that decision needs to be made. But he said, "But that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace to the hearers." So there are two things that need to come out of. One is we need to be sure. One decision we need to make is nothing corrupt will ever come out of your mouth. And you know, I decided years ago, as long as I live, I never want a man to be able to tell a dirty joke or anything that's off color and say, "Max Barnett told me that." And men, you need to make a decision about that. You really do. You need to be an example in what comes out of your mouth. And he said, be an example in word. Be an example in conversation, or literally in conduct. You need to be an example there, men. The quality of life that you live. The quality of life that we live is so important to God. You ought to study sometime 1 Timothy chapter 3, beginning with about verse 1 and down through verse 8, as Paul talks about the qualifications for leadership, bishop or overseer or leader. And I think it's basically true for anyone that's going to be in any kind of leadership. If you're leading a Bible study or whatever you're doing, and you'll notice out of all of those characteristics that Paul lists, basically they all have to do with character except being apt to teach. And he did talk about how to manage your own household. And you'll find the same thing in Titus, in Titus 1, beginning with verse 7, that the thing is so important to God. Isn't it amazing that when God talks about a pastor, everything he says about him has to do with his character, except he's also got to be able to teach and manage his own household well. Fellows, godliness is a thing that's very, very important to God. And God has amazing ways of taking very common, ordinary people that are not all that gifted and doing something with them if they'll walk with Him and live a holy life. And I hope holiness to you will not be a word we just turn over to certain groups, but that the goal of your life will be to be a holy, righteous, godly man. And Paul says, you know how devotedly, how uprightly, how blamelessly we live. And he said of the elder, he is to be blameless. And if Paul wrote to, in Titus 2, 7 and 8, he said, "In all things show yourself a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing uncorruptness, gravity, sincerity, sound speech that cannot be condemned." The idea, that no one can bring an accusation against your life and lay it at your feet and make it stick. Now, you're going to find if you're in a discipleship ministry, there are going to be rumors that may circulate about you. And people may say things about you. But they should never be able to bring something and lay it at your feet and make it stick. They may accuse you of things, but we ought to live the quality of life. And that doesn't mean that there's never any problems, but it does mean that when we've wronged someone, we go make it right, and once you've done that, then they cannot lay anything at your feet and make it stick. And so a holy, righteous, godly life is very important. So we set the pace, first of all, in what we are. And that's what Paul talks about in verse 10. In verse 11, we must set the pace in what we do. And first of all, we set the pace in what we are. We set the pace in what we do. And Paul said here in verse 11, just as you know how we exhorted and encouraged and implored each one of you just as a father would his own children. Now, when we live a godly life and it's our desire to bring men to maturity, we want to bring men to full maturity in Christ. We go out to share the gospel. The very first question a young Christian has, sometimes he doesn't know how to say it, but many times what is in his mind is, now that I'm a Christian, how do I live this life? That's the very thing Paul deals with. He set the example before them in the kind of character that he was. And then the scriptures say that he exhorted them. He encouraged them. He challenged them. He taught them. And so we're to be an example to the people in that area. We're to care for their lives, and we're to exhort them and encourage them. We're to come alongside them. We're to know about their lives. Sometimes they need a word of encouragement. Sometimes they need a word of challenge. Sometimes they need a word of rebuke. And we're to be there with a holy life living before them and being God's representative and being a holy, godly man as much as we're capable of being. Then they will be receptive to what we say. And when a word of challenge comes from you, they know your life backs it up. A word of encouragement comes from you, they know the kind of person you are. When you have to rebuke them, they know the kind of person you are, and they're much more likely to take it. And so if we're going to have a multiplying ministry, then we've got to set the pace. We've got to live a quality of life, and then there's certain things that we have to do. Now, I want you to notice the last thing. We set the goal, we set the pace, and then we share our lives. Look what Paul says in verse 7. We prove to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. Now, I want you to notice something. Paul said back in verse 11 that he exhorted, encouraged, and implored each one of you as a father would his own children. Now, he mentions the term father here. The father aspect, as I think presented, is more the idea of leadership, of rebuke, of challenge. And Paul did that. And he said he did it as a father. And if you'll do a study here more closely on this passage, you'll find that the idea is he did all of these things as a father individually would with his children. You know, you teach children individually. When a child, if you have three children at home and one of them is, say, 6 and one is 3 and one is 3 months old, and the 6-year-old comes and he's ready to tie his shoes, you don't say, well, son, I mean, you're 6 and ready to tie your shoes, but your little sister's only 3 and your little brother's only 3 months old and they can't tie their shoes. So let's wait till that little brother that's 3 months old, he gets to be 6. And we'll have a Monday night shoe tying class, and I'll teach all of you at once. I mean, that's absolutely absurd. You don't teach children in classes to tie their shoes. I mean, when that child is ready to tie his shoes, you teach him at that time to tie his shoes. If you don't, he'll keep stumbling over them or go barefooted, or somebody else will teach him. But you have to teach that child when he's ready. And so much of working with individual people is meeting the need when he's ready. And that's why, folks, largely in the 20th century, one of the reasons, And I don't want you to misunderstand this. See, I work with the church. I work with Southern Baptists. But one of the reasons we're becoming more ineffective is because we've lost the man-to-man. I mean, we do large group meetings and we do small group meetings, and you get what your large groups and small groups could do. Now, granted, the large group meetings and the small group meetings could both be improved. But, I mean, even if they are improved, it's not going to take care of everything. You know, I got to thinking one night, and several years ago, my wife and I were laying in bed before we got to sleep. I got to thinking, you know, the best way to get time with my pastor, and I was not in the church I'm in now, but the best way to get time with my pastor is one of two ways. Number one, have a heart attack or get sick. Now, if I get sick, he'll come see me. If I'm in the hospital, he will. He'll come visit me. Or if my wife and I decide to get a divorce and he hears about it, he may come. Now, that one's debatable. But if I get physically sick or spiritually sick, I may see him. But as long as I'm healthy and coming and showing up and dropping in a plate and things, I mean, he's not going to bother me. Now, man, that's sad, but it's true. Because there's no concept of training the healthy ones. Now, as a result of what I said last night, trying to share with you something is coming, the last thing I'd want to see you do is say, man, people got bigger problems. I guess we just can't help them. If that's what you got out of what I said, I'm sorry, friends. I'm saying that we need to get better equipped in the future. And there are some people out there that are going to have some deep problems. But we don't want to give all of our time to those. Some of those people we're going to keep alive in the groups, and the day's going to come in which they're going to be at a point where we can help them. There are going to be some other people in the body of Christ that can help them. We may become better equipped to help some of those people. But we don't want to just neglect those that are healthy. And the Father, Paul said, you exhort each one and comfort him and charge him like a father would with his children. How does a father do it with his children? He does it individually. And that's the idea if you go back and study the Greek text that's there. Not only is there the rebuke and the encouragement and the exhortation of the father, but notice verse 7, there's a tender, loving care of the mother. And notice the word here, the King James says is a nurse takes care of her children. Literally, it's a nursing mother. It's just like a nursing mother. And you know how tender a scene that is when a nursing mother has this little baby, little nursing baby in her arms. And both of those things are necessary if you're going to disciple people. There are times in which you have to be very tender, very loving with them. There are other times when you have to take more of the role of the father, of the exhortation, of the rebuke, of the challenge. You know, I follow the life of John Mark. When Paul went on his first missionary journey, a young man went with he and Barnabas by the name of John Mark. Now, we don't know why John Mark went back. The scriptures say when they headed on up to Pamphylia and up in that area, they left Cyprus and hit the mainland. John Mark went home. We don't know for sure why. The Bible doesn't say, but whatever reason it was, Paul didn't think it was good enough. And if you read about that part of the country, and Paul talked about being in, later in 2 Corinthians 11, being in perils of robbers and perils of shipwreck and all these things. And even up through that region, as you go through some of those narrow mountain areas, as Paul went on up north through that region, they said even the mighty Roman armies were never able to get that area rid of the robbers. And it may have been that young John Mark, as he stood on the shore that day and he looked up through there and he knew a lot of people that went through there got beat up and robbed, and he might have decided it is more comfortable going home. But when they started on their second journey, John Mark wanted to go with them. Barnabas wanted him to go. And Paul didn't. In the Bible, beautiful thing about the Bible, it tells it like it is, there's a sharp contention arose among them. It was so sharp that Barnabas decided to take John Mark, and Paul said, that's fine, you can take him if you want to, but he's not going with me. And so he takes Silas, and he heads up the mainland, and Barnabas takes John Mark, and they head across and start retracing the steps where they'd gone before. Now, you know, it's interesting to note that the last letter Paul ever wrote from 2 Timothy, he said, send John Mark, for he's profitable to me for the ministry. And you know one thing I think God used in John Mark's life? I think God used the encouragement and the tenderness and the understanding of his uncle Barnabas. But I also think that John Mark never forgot the stinging rebuke that he got from the Apostle Paul, because the Scriptures say he went not with them to the work. And I think God used both. And I think you'll see that in lives as you work with men. There needs to be the encouragement and much of it. And the rebuke is probably not a great deal, but when it comes, it's effective because of the love and the tenderness that you've shown them. And so we need to share our lives. When I met the Navigators, I'd finished my third year in college. I was leading some witnessing clinics, and a group of us at Texas A&M had started out to witness, and we didn't know how. We were scared to death, but we knew we ought to do it. And I was sharing with someone today, when I first started out, I started out one day down the hall in the dorm where I lived, and I prayed, and I knew I ought to witness, and I had four verses written on the fly leaf of my Bible that a Sunday school teacher had given us years before. And so I started down the hall, and as I walked along, I saw a door open and a fellow sitting at a desk there by himself. And so I walked on down the end of the hall and read the bulletin board. And I prayed some more, and I walked back and I got a drink at the water fountain. And I went back and read the bulletin board, and I walked by a number of times before I had the courage to walk in there and witness to him. But a group of us started. And one night, my roommate, when I was a sophomore, came in from next door, and he said, "You know, Max," and I'd just started witnessing, and he said, "You know, I've never led anybody to the Lord." And I said, "Is that right?" Just like I knew a lot about it. And I said to him, I said, "Do you want to?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "All right, then let's go. And let's go tonight, and let's go every night till somebody accepts the Lord." He said, "Let's start tonight." He said, "Man, I got a test tomorrow." I said, "Well, I got a paper due too. I mean, it won't take long. Let's just go talk to somebody. Maybe we can't talk long, but we'll go every night till somebody accepts the Lord. Is that all right with you?" And he said, "Yeah." So we started till somebody accepted the Lord. He was driving a laundry truck that spring out to the air base, and I know that spring is 14 guys that he picked up that came to know the Lord. And you know, we started witnessing, and we started seeing some things happen, and we didn't know about follow-up. We'd never heard about that. And so we started going around to some other campuses that we'd get calls from BSUs and lead witnessing clinics. And I'd been at Ridgecrest, North Carolina. Well, I'd been at Tennessee Tech the week before and been meeting with some fellows. So I said to a group of fellows that night, and we sat up till about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd taken those guys to witness, just met them that week, and we'd seen several people become Christians. And so that night we visited till about 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, "Fellas, I know you've got to work this summer, and I do too, in order to go to school. So why don't we just rent a house somewhere, and we'll move into some city, and we'll rent a house, and we'll work during the day, and then at night we'll come home, and we'll read the Bible and pray, and we'll go witness, and we'll get involved in a church, and I'll teach you, we'll memorize verses, and I'll teach you everything I know about God. Now, I may not know much more than you do, but I'll teach you everything I know." So I caught a bus that morning about 5 o'clock. I had to go to Ridgecrest, and I got there, and a fellow by the name of Waylon Moore was there. And a friend of mine said, "You know, there's this fellow here who's been with Billy Graham, and said he's going to be speaking over at my dorm, over to a group of students. Would you like to come?" Well, I'd heard of Billy Graham, so I went over there, and that day we sat in that room, and Waylon began to tell us about Dawson Trotman. He said, "You know, Dawson was a fellow that, you know, he had a house, and he'd have people live with him, and said they'd work during the day, and at night they'd come in and read the Bible, and they'd pray and guys. I didn't have that much training myself. I didn't know what to do, but I knew one thing, that you got after guys. And I didn't know all that you did, but I knew some things." And so we started trying to share our lives with guys. We shared our ignorance. I mean, I'm sure we did a lot of things wrong. I've gone to conferences since and heard people say some things that you do, and I say, "Uh-oh, that's not the way I did it." But I know some of those guys that are walking with God today. You know, it's kind of like raising kids. You can make some mistakes a long way, and kids still turn out real good. But you've got to share your life with them. Later, when we came to the University of Oklahoma, we came praying. And one of the things I wanted to do, because just of the case situation where I'd been, I knew one thing. I wanted to raise up a different kind of Baptist. And so we started praying when we first came, and I knew one thing, that if we were going to do something to BSU, we had to start in evangelism. There were already some kids around. So we moved in on Saturday, joined church on Sunday, and I determined the first day at the job I'd be out witnessing at night. And so we went out to witness. We started taking students with us, and then we started a Bible study. And I started a little Bible study on 1 Thessalonians. Out of that group, we had some fellows with us, and I was kind of watching to see who was interested. And we picked some fellows out of that group, and then we started meeting with them. And many times, it'd come time to meet with them. I didn't know exactly what to do, so we'd read the Bible and pray, and we'd go over verses. And I was trying to learn what I could at the time. But I brought them into my heart and shared with them. And we spent a lot of time praying. We spent a lot of time just reading the Bible and going out to witness, and we'd go out on retreats. We'd pick up some tapes and take tapes out, and we'd listen to them, and they'd ask questions, and sometimes I didn't know what the answer was, but we shared what we knew. And out of that group of fellows, we had another fellow, one guy that the fellow led to the Lord, and we had this little group, and out of that group, eventually it kind of settled down to where there were about five fellows, and one of those fellows is BSU director at the University of Nebraska, and he's been there for 15 years. Other fellow's a BSU director at Kansas State University, where he's been for 15 years. The third one went to Iowa State University, where he had been BSU director for 13 years, and has now been in Korea the last 2 years working with students in Busan after he's gotten out of language school. There was a fifth fellow that, as that group kind of settled down, that later moved to Lincoln, Nebraska to help start the ministry there. And you know, I began to see some things. Man, it's not always what you know. If you're teachable and you're learning and you're willing to share your heart with your guys, I mean, God will use that. You know, I've wondered sometimes when this thing of training is so important, why isn't it spelled out, and why isn't in the Bible there's not a 5-page section somewhere where it says you do this, 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 and this? Even about evangelism, sometimes you find the word used reconciliation, and its idea of bringing together. Other places you find the word redemption, its idea of buying back. You find different words used even for the same idea. Born again, you were dead in sins and now you've been born again. And Jesus used all those words. And Paul did. And it's not always spelled out as carefully as we'd like to be. Man, it's just a matter of get you some guys, walk with God, share your lives with them. I want to close with one story, and I know some of you have heard it, but I like to tell it, so don't interrupt me. You know, one area that we saw, and I think it illustrates a point, one area where we saw where guys on our campus that we were totally missing happened to be the athletes. Now, I don't believe for 1 minute before God they're any more important than anyone else, but it's just here's a group of guys that nobody's reaching. And I talked with one of the boys one day I'd met at church. There were 120 guys on the football team at that time, and he was on the third team. And I asked him one time, I said, do any guys go to church? He said, Max, none of them. I said, you're kidding. He said, Max, if you don't believe it, you come over here some Sunday morning. And he said, it is like a tomb. I'm the only one. If we don't have to get up and run on Sunday or something, he said, I'm the only one that goes to church. So we started praying for that area of the campus. And one day, we felt around over there and tried to get a foot in the door, and it didn't work out, so we continued to pray and wait. And one day I got a call from a Catholic coach and said, there's a boy we're trying to recruit. We really want him. And said he's got one of the fastest times in the nation in the hurdles. He's an outstanding kid, most sought-after boy in Texas that year, and said we'd really like to have him. He happens to be a Baptist. Well, as I met the boy, I found out that his parents were far more interested in religion than he was. But I met him, and I went over to him after I got to know him a little bit, and at the first of the year, and I said, would it be okay if we led a Bible study in your room? I'd like to start a Bible study with freshmen, and I don't want anybody to come that's not a freshman football player. I don't even want you to tell the varsity we're meeting. I said, I'd like to have a Bible study with just freshmen. I said, would you come if I had a Bible study? Now, you got 168 hours in a week, and I want one of them for a Bible study. Now, you're not going to flunk out of school because you still got 167 hours left. And I said, could we do that? And he said, well, yeah. He said, where are we going to meet? And I said, well, how about your room? We were sitting in it. And his roommate was a big old, about 255-pound freshman sophomore, freshman tackle and offensive tackle. And I looked over to him and I said, Eddie, would it be all right with you if we met in your room? He said, oh, it'd be all right with me. I said, well, since we're meeting in your room, would you come? He kind of grinned. He said, I'd come. I said, well, great. Now, fellas, don't tell the varsity we're meeting. I don't even want them to know. And Joe's eyes got big because he was raised in the Baptist church. And he said, you mean if somebody wanted to come, you don't want them to come? I said, Joe, that's exactly what I mean. I don't want them to come. I said, now, don't worry about the upperclassmen. I said, if we get started right with freshmen, eventually we'll reach upperclassmen. See, that's one of the problems we've got in the church today, fellas. It's kind of the idea that, say, here's an old dry creek bed and a storm starts up here 1,500 miles in a flood, and we run down 5 yards and throw a sandbag. Run down another 5 yards and throw another sandbag. Now, if we're going to stop the onrush to hell, somebody's going to have to get down there 1,500 miles and start pouring concrete. And men, that's why you have got to build lasting foundations. And you're going to do that as you give your life to people. Now, there are a lot of programs. There are a lot of things you can get involved with. And you ought to be faithful in your church and do some things. But at the same time, you have got to start building some men. And so, we decided to do that. Now, there were 45 players that they were allowed to recruit. And I think they actually had 43 that year. And I said, so let's go after the other 41. And they kind of looked at each other and grinned and said, Max, you don't know these guys, do you? I said, no, I don't. They said, well, we're not sure they'll come. I said, fellas, I'm not sure they'll come either. But we can invite them. I mean, fellas, the Bible study's on there already three. I'm going to be there and you two. The pressure's off. So let's just invite them. And so they said, fine. And I said, I'll come over this week. And I went over three nights that week and we ran around and we tried to see every one of those boys. And I went over there, said, getting off practice that day, and they had to, they'd go to the dining hall and eat. So I'd stand over by the dining hall where every one of them had to see me. And I'd invite them. And then it came time to the Bible study and we walked in the room and there was these two fellows and one guy next door. I said, guys, wait just a minute. And so I went down and I'd knock on the door and I said, hey, get on down there. That Bible study is starting. You're going to be late. And so we started going out and trying to round them up. Now, you know, I say that, fellas. You know, the world is really up for grabs. Most of the guys that come to OU or any other place, they're the kind of guys that you can go by and say, let's go get a beer, and they'd go get a beer. Or if you go by and say, let's go to Bible study, and if you go after them, they can be reached. And so the first night, we had about, I believe the first night we had 16 guys to show up. Or first night we had 15. The next night we had 16. The next night we had 9. And it leveled off at about 7. And never one time did we have under 5. And we worked and we invited them to church and none of them would go. Finally, one or two of the guys started going. And it took me from September to February to get that first boy we'd met to memorize his first verse. But he was a sharp fella. He had a 4-point, went through the university. He made 1 B in his entire life, and that was in 5th grade music. And so we worked on him. And the next year, we took two of those fellas, and they started Bible study along that spring. I said, now when the freshmen get here next year, I want you guys to be the first ones they meet. And one of the guys said, Max, you don't understand how we operate. We don't have anything to do with the freshmen until after spring practice, and then we throw them in the duck pond, and then we're buddies. I said, I don't care if you throw them in a duck pond, but fellas, I think it's a tragic thing that these guys would come and when they're so reachable those first few weeks that you wouldn't have anything to do with them. I said, I think your tradition is wrong, so change it. Well, this one of the linebackers, he said, I'll think about it. I said, you do that. So the next week I came back and he said, I've thought about it. You're right. We'll get after him. So the next fall they did. These two guys led Bible studies. They both died. They weren't ready to lead Bible studies. And so we kind of gathered them up and I taught them. Well, we saw several fellows, and first thing you know, we had four or five guys become Christians. And we had three or four guys that go to church with us. And that year on the Big 8 team, there were 10 seniors on the offensive team and one sophomore, that boy Joe Wiley. So I said to Joe along that spring, I said, Joe, boy, you can make a lot of money this summer, can't you? He said, yeah, the coaches can get me a good job. I said, Joe, you know, there's something you need worse than money. I said, you know what you need worse than you need anything else under God's heaven? You need help in your Christian walk. I said, Joe, you know what could happen here by the time you're a senior? I said, do you think God has ever in the history of the world been able to do what he wanted to do on one football team in one dorm? His eyes kind of got big. He said, I don't know. I said, I don't know either, but it's an interesting thought, isn't it? And he said, yeah. I said, Joe, I got a job for you too this summer. We need a janitor to BSU. We got an apartment there, and I'll let you live there this summer. And you can work 4 hours a day. You know how much I'll pay you? I won't pay you anything. I'll let you live there. But I promise you one thing, Joe, if you'll do that, I'll pay you one thing. I will give you my life. So he said, I'll think about that. I said, now, Joe, you can go make a lot of money, but you don't need money. You're on a full scholarship. Your parents got some money. But what you need is help. And you better get it while you can. So he came back and he said, I'll do it. So he stayed that summer and he's gotten a lot of invitations to speak. And you could read more in the sports page sometimes about religion than you could in the religious page. And he'd tell reporters about his quiet time and things. And a lot of churches were calling, and so we let him go speak some. And we took some long trips that year. I got in the car and we'd ride to Kansas City and he'd speak and I'd sit in the balcony. And we'd talk and we'd pray. And the next year out of that group, we had them leading Bible studies and we had five Bible studies going. And we each year turn around on the freshmen, and at the time, the spring of their junior year, we said, now, fellas, this is what we've been working towards. Next year, we want to go all out to reach the freshman class. So that spring, we met, and we had a weekend to pray, and we got a list of all the recruits, and we let the fellas pick the guys they wanted in their Bible study. Now, these kids are still back in high school, finishing their senior year, and we're deciding whose Bible study they're going to be in. And this guy says, well, I'm a tackle. I'm an offensive tackle. This guy's an offensive tackle. You let me have him. Or one of the guys said, I met this guy when he came to be recruited, and I want him. And so we divided them up. And I said, now, fellas, if you'll give us another weekend, we can go visit many of the guys. And, you know, I remember one day, as a result of all this, that one of the fellows here tonight, Jeep Dewberry. Jeep was starting center on OU football team when he was a sophomore. He was in an older class, but as a result of some of the things, I remember one night walking into the dorm, and I started in the dorm and Jeep walked in. He said, hey, I need to talk to you. And he'd been in Sunday school class that morning. And the teacher hadn't shown up or something, and two of the fellows that we'd been working with, one of them was a gymnast who had become a Christian about 9 months before. And he'd been in Sunday school class, and those guys had shared verses back and forth. And I remember Jeep saying to him, he said, you know, I've never seen anybody in my life that knows the Bible like Mike Maxey. And I could hardly keep from laughing. When Mike Maxey had become a Christian 9 months before, I asked him about his religious background when I was talking to him. He said, what do you mean? I said, Mike, I mean, what church do you go to? And he said, I don't go to church. I said, well, if you went, where would you go? Would it be Catholic, Methodist? He said, I don't know. I said, what about your mom and dad? Which one would they go to? He said, well, I don't know. I said, Mike, have you ever been in church in your life? And he thought for a minute. He said one time that it wasn't for a funeral or a wedding. And he told me about that time. And he went in a Sunday school class and they were flipping back and forth and somebody asked him to look up for a verse and he said, I didn't know where it was and I thought I'd never go back. He said, it's the only time in my life I've ever been in church. And so I took him to church with me and I said, now you take notes. Any question you have, you can ask me. So the pastor got him. He said, the God of Israel. And boys, I noticed a blank look going down his head. As soon as church is over, he came up to me and he said, is that where God was born? I'd never seen anybody in my life so ignorant as he was. 9 months later, he's in a Sunday school class, and Jeep says, I've never seen anybody knows the Bible like he does. Because he had been memorizing verses, and it was so refreshing just to see the way he grew. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we had a little celebration, the 20th year we were there, and one of the fellows that flew in is a training pilot in Houston, Rick Carr. Rick won the gymnastics title at the time before they took it out of gymnastics. He won the trampoline as a sophomore and was number 3 in the nation. And Mike started witnessing to him. And one night they lived out at the old barracks where they worked out, and there's a doorway between them. And one night, Mike was just this young Christian and so excited, and he walked in and he sat down on Rick's bed and he said, Rick, do you think you're about ready to become a Christian? And he said, well, Mike, said, I've been thinking about it, but I don't think I'm quite ready yet. And Mike said, well, let me share a verse with you. And he shared Revelation 3:20, behold, I stand at the door and knock. And he shared that verse and he went in another room and went to bed. And just before he went to sleep, Mike just reached over and he went, he didn't say a word. He just knocked on the wall 3 times. Rick was later telling me about this. He said, man, I laid there and I kept hearing that knock, knock, knock. And he thought, boy, I need to become a Christian. I mean, what if I don't wake up in the morning? And Mike's been telling me I'll go to hell. And so finally he thought, I'll go wake Mike up. It's about 1:30 in the morning by this time. And he thought, boy, that wouldn't be nice. And he thought, well, yeah, it would. He's the one who started all this. So he went in there and he woke Mike up and became a Christian that night. And Jeep and others came along. And some of those upperclassmen that Joe was so wild-eyed about it the first time, they were reached. And so we decided we'd scatter and go visit those boys in their home that summer before they came to school. And so out of the some 45 boys, we visited 26 of them in their home. One boy drove from Norman, Oklahoma to Hobbs, New Mexico to knock on the door to invite one guy to be in his Bible study. He said, when you get there next fall, I want you to be in my Bible study. Well, the next fall, out of 45 guys, we had 30 a week in Bible study. And someone asked Coach Fairbanks one time, said, how in the world are you ever going to get the team up for this? We had 3 games, and all 3 of those games in a row were all of the teams we were playing were in the top 5 teams in the nation. He said, don't worry about it. The Christians will take care of it. Now, they didn't all become Christians, but we saw God do a phenomenal work in a 4-year period. And I remember one night walking, going over to dorms, and I knocked on the door on the first floor, and I think it was Jeep's room, and he came to the door, and there were a bunch of guys in there listening to some tapes on the Christian life. And he said, come on in, we're just listening to a tape. He said, oh, no, you guys are doing great. Go ahead. So I went up to the second floor. I knocked on another boy's door, and he opened the door, and there were a number of guys in there, and they were praying. He said, oh, come on in, Max. We're just praying. I said, oh, man, you guys continue. Go right ahead. So I went up to the third floor, and I knocked on another boy's door, and he opened the door, and the Bible was open on his desk, and he'd been telling me he was praying for the guy across the hall, and he winked at me, and I knew what was going on. I said, hey, Joe, looks like you're busy. I'll see you later. And I walked down the hall and I said, God, there's nothing need for me to be here. I'm going home. Now, we didn't see them all become Christians, but we saw God do some phenomenal things. And from the point in where we had one guy, and one time I'm sitting in church there one Sunday, and I can count 17 football players, and I just saw 2 more go up, on the first floor, and I just saw 2 more go up in the balcony. And I can turn on the TV set any day where there's a pro game and see guys that I knew from that group that are playing ball, and many of them, some of them even still to this day. And that work went on for a number of years. Men, I think many, many times when I'd leave that dorm, and sometimes it'd be many times 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'd meet with guys and I'd think, God, you know, I don't know if I did everything right, but I did the best I knew to do. And men, if you will set the goal, I knew what I wanted. I wanted to see them come to full maturity. Now, some of them didn't. There was a stage in their life. Some of them are still growing. And God did a real work. We know that for sure. And so when you set the goal, and you know where you're going with guys, you'll share the gospel with them and try to bring them as best you can to full maturity. You'll set the pace in what you are and in what you do. And you will share your life with them. Bring them in. We've had them sleeping in our house on the floor. We took trips together. We took 24 of them after the bowl game up to Glen Eyrie. We did fun things with them. We spent a lot of time with them. We didn't have all that structure to program in some ways, but as best we knew, we shared our life. And men, that's what Paul did. And if you'll do that, you'll have a multiplying ministry. Thank you.